Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is Frank Portman, Dr. Frank. He's the founder and frontman of the legendary Berkeley punk band, the Mr. T Experience, and author of the novels King Dork, King Dork Approximately, and Andromeda Klein. Welcome to Free Thoughts, Frank.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you get into punk rock?
Well, I suppose the way I first heard it was on the radio. And that would have been, I turned 13 in 1977, which was the date, the punk rock date. And I lived in a very sleepy suburb with pretty much no contact with the world outside it other than the radio. And I believe the first time I ever heard anything that you could categorize as punk rock was on the Dr. Demento show. And, but there were all sorts of other radio, all radio contexts in which you could hear punk rock at the time. It was the supposedly underground happening thing, in the world of culture at the time, but there were these specialty shows on all the major radio stations that would play. There was one called the Outlaws and one called the Heretics. And then there were college radio stations. Then I would just sort of huddle by my radio trying to ride the dial, trying to find the interesting things that were all bunched up on the left, and they would all left of the dial, and they would all bleed into each other. And as far as why it appealed to me, it was not what was being paid attention to by any of my peers. So I felt that this was something I could adopt as my own kind of emblem. It would set me apart from everyone who I hated. The rhetoric of it was very salutary in that regard as well, because there was a lot of rhetoric in these songs that I was listening to about alienation, about hating people, and so forth. So I really gravitated towards that. That phase didn't last too long, but while it lasted, I was all punk rock all the time. And I had to go through a lot of, I don't know, there were some, a degree of, I think a lot of people who are my age who were interested in punk rock at that time probably have a similar story. It was sort of mild to medium level harassment from everybody once they found out that you were a punk rock person. And so I was, there were some fisticuffs involved in certain, you know, hey, punk rock, hey, Devo. That was the thing that they used to say. I'll tell you the best anecdote of this with little Dr. Frank and the radio, where there was a show that I liked to listen to that was on the Stanford college radio station, KZSU. And it was very hard to tune in. But I found out that there was this one tree that I could climb with my little radio, that I could, if I climbed to a certain height, I could get the show that I wanted to listen to. And so I would do this during the lunch period at my intermediate school. I was in seventh grade. And that was a great way to spend lunch until I was discovered by the other kids. There were a lot of mean guys that you encounter in school as in life. And so they thought it's kind of obvious the thing to do when there's a scrawny little guy up in a tree listening to radio, you throw rocks at him. So that ended my experiment with high wire antenna seeking. I would do anything for KZSU and punk rock, but I would not do that. So I had to come down to earth, so to speak.
Does that make punk rock somewhat inherently political in a very broad sense, that it somewhat defines your relationship to other people, and a lot of political attitudes are actually about your relationship, what you think of other people, and if the establishment is doing X, like listening to disco, then it's kind of a political move to not do that. Obviously, but like it has political undertones.
Kind of, yes. Although then there's the irony of that becoming, if not the absolute mainstream, becoming as, you know, so close to it as it might as well be. And then now I think, you know, when Green Day became the biggest rock band in the universe and probably the last big rock band that there will ever be, it becomes there's a bit of irony talking about this social rebellion that I was referring to and that you're talking about. And that goes all the way back to the beginning. When I was 13, I was the only person I knew who was aware of The Clash, say. What I didn't realize at the time was that, you know, they were like one of the biggest things going. They were in Time magazine. They were on television. They were as mainstream as you get as well. There was nothing other than your own personal mythology that you build up when you adopt these things as your thing that you're interested in. There was nothing that different to distinguish The Clash from any other rock band as far as your relationship to society for deciding to like them. I mean, obviously, you could point to differences between different bands and what they sound like and what it means that they sound like that and so forth, which is a whole other question. But so I agree with what you said, but I think that there's a line of irony that runs through the whole thing, which makes the rebellion angle of punk rock very hard to pin down in many cases. And it makes the behavior of people that are infused with that spirit often rather silly. I've been involved in this since I was a little kid, involved in it as an oddball off to the side, not involved in it as a central activist or anything. But I've always one of the reasons I was always an oddball to the side on this is the same reason I was an oddball in seventh grade. I just don't get along with communities of people, and I don't like the idea of communities of people. And while the sentiments of a lot of these bands that I was listening to when I was at the prime age relating to this kind of coincided with that sense of alienation, there was a greater world of a so-called punk rock community in which the same dynamic was busy at work, marginalizing and ostracizing with the oddballs like me, with our, you know, not against our will. I was always happy to be ostracized. but I've always felt, even as a little kid, I must be doing something right, even though that carries with it a bit of misery.
Well, that puts me in mind of, I think punk rock for me played a big role in my development as eventually a political thinker and the path that I took, but I realized this sense of alienation and the kind of subversion of the mainstream part of it, whether that was authentic or not, that I think I might be able to therefore credit you with putting me on this path because my first, like, I guess, The very first punk rock show I ever attended, I think I was a freshman in high school, and maybe a sophomore. I don't remember, but I it was to see you guys perform at the Shelter in Detroit with I think the band Telegraph, and because my friend Mike Wheeler said you guys were good, and then he and I we sat in a car in the parking lot at my high school listening to. The album Love Is Dead, and the president of our student council president, who was a square and was very Republican, and he used to read Rush Limbaugh's books in class. And he walked by.
Square is not a good enough word for this guy.
he walked by us two scrawny kids in our crappy car in the high school parking lot, and I think the song Ba 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 was playing, and he stuck his head in, and in his role as student council Republican president, said, "That's the fruitiest song I've ever heard."
Well, I love that story that that encompasses and encapsulates not only common experience in a general way, but also the relationship of people who like my band to the band. You're always having to defend it from people. It's interesting because, you know, I grew up in California. We didn't have guys like that. I never met someone who would have done the equivalent of reading a Rush Limbaugh book. I mean, the guy who would do that where I grew up, he would have been carrying the Noam Chomsky book. But it's a similar, it's the same dynamic, really. There's a acceptable complex of behavior, attitudes, and it mostly boils down to manners and etiquette that is safe and vindicated by the community at large. And one of the ways that you prove you're part of that acceptable community is to identify the weaker elements and attack them. And this is something that once you have recognized that pattern, which is something I did recognize at a very young age, you see it played out over and over and over again in pretty much every context that there is. And I think that's something that I was it was an important lesson I was taught. That is a political insight. It doesn't make you want to join a party. In fact, you know, quite the opposite. Yeah. Unless your ambition is you really want to be that guy, which I never felt like I wanted to.
Well, so then how did you go from being the 13-year-old climbing trees to listen to the radio to then playing in a punk rock band?
You know, so you listen to bands and you have a fantasy life where you're a member of a band, where you're in a band, you're the greatest band in the world in your head. And, you know, you practice, you know, you start miming playing the guitar with a tennis racket, and then you maybe switch to an actual guitar at some point. And it's very much like when you first start doing it. When I first started doing it, it was very much like playing Batman or Star Trek or Billy Jack or whatever we used to play. For me, that kind of current of fantasy extended through up all the way through when I, entered high school, became a teenager, and then you gradually got more elaborate with the playing Batman, and so, or playing rock star. So you had a real guitar, and you found some other guys to play with, and you pretended to be a band, and you would have pretend shows, which at first was just in, you know, the basement, and then you managed to maybe finally find a place to play. But it was you see the dichotomy that I'm setting up. There is a real world of real rock stars, real show business, and then you have this fantasy imaginary version of it that you play at. And then for me and people like me, this mirror, this sort of rather pathetic parallel version of the real thing continues on for your whole life, and you wind up with a sort of career. But it never, when I first realized that I had a band that some people thought was a real band, it was, you know, sometime in the 90s, and it just really shocked and amused me because it never quite seemed real. And it never was real in the sense that, I mean, nobody ever got rich over the Mr. T experience in any way, shape, or form. It didn't justify itself economically at all. And sort of in terms of the gratification that you get from being in a band, you do have a lot of fun in being in a band. You meet a lot of girls, you have a lot of interesting experiences, but it's I've only recently, just very recently in the last few years, had the experience where I can look back on it and pick bits of it out that seem edifying, where I can say, I'm glad I did that. Look, I did that. That's, you know, I didn't know what I was doing at the time. But that kind of, you know, where you have a satisfying artistic career, that always, that never seen, that was never part of the world of doing it. And as far as what you are thinking of when you do it, the whole time when you're in a kind of a marginal operation, like not just my band, almost all the bands, hardly any bands are ever successful in any, to any degree. You don't know why you're doing it. And you're thinking, what the hell am I doing here? Nobody's at this show. This is the last one I ever do. And then you end up for some reason doing another one.
And then you do it for 10 years. Next thing you know, or longer. When you started out in the Bay Area with the political scene in the punk world, that there's a lot of association with, say, the Sex Pistols and Margaret Thatcher and the Coal Towns. And then, of course, Reagan America. I was listening to Black Flag the other day and definitely on some live albums and definitely some references there. Was that pretty much the kind of scene that the politics of the scene that you came up in?
Oh yeah. I mean, when I never liked that. Mostly because of the aesthetics of hardcore, hardcore being whatever was happening at that time when my band was starting, the mid-80s, early 80s to mid-80s. And I used to complain about it at the time and joke about it that, you know, all the songs were they were all Reagan bands. All the songs were about Reagan or El Salvador. And partly, I got a lot of energy out of the fact that when my band started out and we were playing we were doing it quite ineptly, but we were attempting to play pop songs, traditional topics. Hopefully you add a little twist to them to make it justify its existence. But basically it's, you know, pop songs about girls, love songs, breakup songs, that sort of thing. Very traditional approach to music, which was extremely offensive to the quote political establishment. It's like, where's your El Salvador song? You know, where's your Reagan song? It's like, I was Reagan band. Oh, now we're playing with four Reagan bands. And the reason that I didn't like it though, was if you wrote a great song about Reagan, I would be the first to applaud it. But what I didn't particularly care for was the fact that there was very little attention paid to the songwriting. The songs were not that good. The bands all played really fast, so there was not much rock and roll about it. And then, you know, lastly and least importantly, although maybe most annoyingly, it was all very preachy. Is a combination of ideological preaching and almost complete ignorance, which about what they were ostensibly talking about. So I rebelled against that immediately. But the way that I felt about it at the time was just, you know, I was born too late. Why couldn't I have been 20 years old in 1977? Then I would have jumped into a world where the punk bands were still playing pop songs. How I felt it at the time.
That relationship to punk bands and Republican administration, I think it's probably still continuing to this day. But for yourself, other than rebelling against the sort of predominant and somewhat banal political views that were everywhere, did you have political views yourself that were you thought that at that time that they were overstating or wrong about what they were saying?
You know, I've revised this opinion a bit now. I assumed that nobody believed any of the things that they were saying and that they were just faking it. And I think to a large degree they were. I think now that probably I've had more experience of ideologically committed people to realize that it is possible to endorse the silliest rhetoric as though it's, you know, comes from God on high. But on the other hand, the context I grew up in, San Francisco Bay Area, there was no significant in my class Obviously, you can use the word class for this. In my class context, there was no significant political disagreements or divergence from anything. It was just, you know, obviously our interests are the interests of the Democratic Party. And I was as much in that mode as anybody else. My parents, my teachers, clergy, the police, you know, they were all kind of leftish, you know, feel good Democratic partisans. And I never had any reason to think that that wasn't the obvious truth, banal as it is. And it wasn't until I was much older and I actually met some Republicans that I realized that they were actually people. I had never met. Well, I think I met my first Republican at age 25. So, and I, you know, they're actually, a lot of them are pretty nice and not stupid necessarily. There's stupidity is widely distributed across the landscape anyway. But, you know, the thing that I believed at the time and that I would maybe back off from a bit was that there was just, it was appropriating the iconography and rebellion of the previous eras that they were ostensibly in rebellion against, right? I mean, it was punk rock politics of that, at that stage, was hippie politics, basically, even if they might have a Kill the Hippies song. And it's because that was associated in that class. That's the middle to upper middle class people who went to college type people who were almost everybody in that world. In that class, the way that the acceptable way to express youth rebellion was conforming to
ethos, aesthetic, and
there's a, you know, all the leftist rhetoric, I mean, in a very mild way, you know. I mean, the reason why I didn't think that they ever meant it was that, obviously, you know, they would, if they'd be the first up against the wall if the revolution comes, obviously. They're the class enemy, sort of by definition. And, you know, the idea that you are the idea of sort of, I don't know, the apotheosis of rebellion that involves joining this mass of co-thinkers always just seemed like nobody could fail to recognize the paradox there. But in fact, I know that happens all the time. But at that time, but it was all these thoughts were born of just basically hostility to the aesthetic, really, for me. I was resentful of the fact that, you know, if my ideal of punk rock was the Buzzcocks, there was no Buzzcocks to join. There was only, you know, MDC and Reagan Youth and, you know, Intensified Incoherence or whatever the bands were called. And I resented it greatly because I really liked the Buzzcocks. And so my reasoning wasn't necessarily completely sound. But I think there is something in that vague class analysis, because when I was a kid and I was in school, or I was with my parents, or I was with, you know, the clergy, the police, and all the authority figures, there was one way that you could really impress them and get a pat on the head, which was to be, quote, political. And that meant, you know, if some vaguely leftish rhetoric spilled from your mouth, they would give you a gold star and say, well, it's very nice that you're so interested at your age. And we all learned to do it. And I was not above doing that. It was the path of least resistance. But so I probably noticed that in fourth or fifth grade. And then fast forward to San Francisco punk rock scene, that was precisely the dynamic that Tim Yohannan had with all of his acolytes. It was like, it was this.
Who's Tim Yohannan?
Tim Yohannan was the patriarch of the, he lived in San Francisco, patriarch of a certain type of an interpretation of punk rock, which where punk rock wasn't the main thing. Punk, I mean, if you want to talk about political punk, he is the guy that brought the hippie politics into the 80s and made it mandatory for people who wanted to listen to loud and fast music. That's who it was, founder of Maximum Rock and Roll. I knew him a bit. I liked him. He's not around anymore. I liked him very much. I had long conversations with him. During these conversations, I was probably more shocked than I have ever been in my life when I realized that he didn't really like the music that he was championing either. He liked the kind of music I liked, which I was shocked about, because if you listen to Maximum Rock and Roll, it wasn't the Buzzcocks, I can tell you that. But you know, if you looked at his record collection, he had all the Sweet singles, he had all the Stones singles, but he was championing this very unlistenable music. Because he believed that he was a communist. And he believed that this was the way to the revolution and to start a youth movement that would overthrow the government. He really seemed to believe that. So, the idea that you can embody some spirit of rebellion by stepping into a complex of clothing, iconography, and rhetoric, people love to do it. And these authority figures encouraged it, in my way of looking at it at the time. And now I think that's true. I mean, basically this fourth grade situation of your teacher patting you on the head because you've heard of Noam Chomsky continued on through the rest of the social dynamics as I observed it through adulthood.
Wait, so you're kind of rebellion against that, I suppose, in the scene was in playing pop songs about girls. But were there bands around then that were political but were pushing a different sort of politics?
Not in my experience. I mean, so I have to say the scene that became famous around the stuff that we were we're doing. One of the things that characterized it, and one of the things that was good about it, was a de-emphasis of that, and more of an emphasis on what makes music interesting and fun. So I would accept. I mean, it's the kind of hardcore political thing where every band was like they had to issue position papers on the issues of the day. That wasn't a part of that scene. However, in the passive way where everyone pretty much agreed with everyone else on this kind of watery left liberalism, that never changed in my world. And in fact, there was a scary other politics associated with quote punk, was the right wing, the Nazi punks and that sort of thing. I never directly encountered that other than in denunciations of it, by Maximum Rock and Roll. And it turns out, now that he, was like the witch finder general, he went a bit too far. And, if you read the Agnostic Front, stuff that in the book and that has come out lately, I think, he was unjust towards them, but at the time they terrified me and I didn't want anything to do with that. The way that a communist denounces someone is to call them a Nazi, no matter who they are. Right. So, and that was what Tim did. He wanted control over the intellectual current associated with punk, and it was his idiosyncratic in some ways, but in other ways, quite mainstream communist. I mean, he was like a communist organizer in many ways, and he was trying to, you know, gather the youth around and to use them to create a vanguard. All of the stuff that when you read it in the theory just seems so preposterous. You know, some people did try to put it in practice very literally, and Tim was one of those guys. And he was successful at it in his way, but also the success that he had was also the San Francisco Bay Area, which is, you know, basically a monoculture, even now and certainly then, you would have to go to, I mean, in this class of people where the highest thing you could do was to be regarded as political. Yep. You get a political medal, and that's great. And the reason why the class angle of it is so salient is because, I mean, I think it goes back to universities. I mean, do you ever wonder why, this is something I wondered at the time and I wonder now, why the terrorist groups of the 70s that were most salient here were the Weatherman and the Symbionese Liberation Army. Mm-hmm. They had precisely the same rhetoric. They had, they did the same sorts of things. They were the same people, basically. But the Weather Underground came out of the university system that were people like us. And I think that people associated them with some kind of higher truth, higher meaning that was leftist political, whereas these SLA bozos were saying the rhetoric, but they didn't have the antecedents. And this is the reason why I'm thinking of this in connection with punk rock, is that a lot of the aesthetic that and the kind of accoutrements of the punk iconography seems to have come directly from that world. And when I went to my first punk rock show, pretty much, which was The Clash at Kezar Stadium, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to punk, but I was 13 years old. And the thing that happened when you left the concert hall, picked up all of your punk rock stuff. Like if you went to see, you know, Steve Miller, you'd get your Steve Miller shirt and your Steve Miller hat and stuff. Well, what you got was people handed you the Revolutionary Worker. And I swear to God, somewhere I have a handbill for the RAF, which is the Red Army Fraction, the Baader-Meinhof gang. And I thought it was cool. It had a machine gun in a circle, and it looked like a punk flyer. Well, you know, that aesthetic in a sort of only half understood way in many cases of what it refers to cycled through the generations of punk, and you still see it now. It's like a lot of these things came as sort of crashing revelations to me. It's like, wow, I was carrying around this terrorist flyer. And when my dad came to pick me up and he saw my armful of revolutionary communist propaganda that I was coming back from the Clash concert with, and I just remember the one thing he said, sort of staring off into space, was like, you know, the communists often try to find alienated youth of high intelligence. And like, well, they didn't catch me, but so to answer to your question, no, there I never encountered this scary right wing. Even though it certainly existed, it existed in Europe, and I guess there were skinheads here as well. Although I never believed I never thought anybody was serious about anything because I thought, how could they be?
Mm-hmm. Do you have a theory about why the anti-authoritarian countercultural movement would so reject free markets and libertarianism? I mean, is it, do you think it's at all substantive, or are we giving them too much credit?
It's funny because
when
you look at some of these people, conduct their lives, there's something very, I mean, if you look at Maximum Rock and Roll, you know, he built a successful business, and there's this thing that they call DIY that they elevated into kind of a sacred principle. I mean, DIY, at least before I encountered it in the punk rock context, just meant putting up shelves. But if you DIY, you can make your own products, sell them, and keep the money for yourself rather than giving it away to some
corporation,
you know, corporate entity. They were the most committed capitalists that you'd ever meet, but of course not in name. I don't know. I think the explanation has got to be psychological, and because what I'm saying is a lot of the figures in the punk rock world seem that espouse libertarian ideas, certainly, and there was certainly a libertarian as an adjective, strain in a certain sector of the hippie politics that they adopted, again, not in name. So you would think that there would be an affinity. And I think a lot of times as people get older, they recognize that, and you don't, sometimes you don't, but I think there is a mode of associated with youth rebellion, and it goes back to the 60s. And that mode is not,
anti-capitalist.
It's anti-capitalist, right? I mean, regardless of what capitalist means, it's anti that.
Well, do you think that a punk rock band if it's just relative, some of it could just be relative. You have to define the establishment in your head, who you think it is, and then rebel against them. And so wouldn't a punk rock band in the Soviet Union be all for capitalism, be all about free markets?
Well, in fact, you can, I mean, it's not in so much in terms of punk rock, but you know, the example of the Czech dissidents and the
Plastic People Universe,
et cetera. You know, I mean, they were not anti-Western the way their counterparts on the other side were anti-Western, for good reason, right? But I don't know. I wish I knew more about Eastern Bloc punk, so to speak. I mean, my band did a tour of Europe the first time we ever went to Europe. Tour is kind of a grandiose way of putting it. We visited Europe in the summer of 92 and went to several former Eastern Bloc countries pretty close to, when the, to 1989, obviously, you know, 3 years after 1989, including Poland and Belarus and
Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic.
And Czechoslovakia. And the main thing I noticed was there was that these kids had no experience of the scene we were bringing to them at all, and they didn't know what to do, and there was obviously no scene there. I don't think, you know, I mean, obviously, if you are living in a totalitarian country, you're not going to have a punk rock scene, right? So the lesson there is there may be more than 3 years to develop those traditions, and I'm sure now they exist, and now they probably are just aping the American ones, is my guess.
So I want to shift gears a little bit to talk some about your current hobby horse seems to be the freedom of expression issues, mm-hmm. and kind of shame culture and campus speech and so on. So in 2004, you guys put out the album Yesterday Rules, and it has on it one of my favorite songs that you've written, Institutionalized Misogyny, which is a very funny song. It was particularly funny for me because that was when I was finishing up college at the University of Colorado at Boulder as an English major and studying literary criticism and so on. And so was very kind of embedded in the stuff that that song was making fun of. But it occurred to me that that song was funny in 2004. If you were to release that song today, I wonder if how much you would get told that that song is not okay.
Oh, absolutely.
The stuff that you're making fun of. So could you,
there's an interesting, I don't know. It's like, it's true. It's going back in time because at the time, but the inspiration for that song was a conversation I had with a young woman who was on a tour of singer-songwriters, a little brief tour that I did. And there was just this one night where she just was talking kind of canned rhetoric about Foucault, et cetera. And I just found it really amusing. But at the time, I thought, and I was not wrong, I thought that that was the day where that rhetoric ruled supreme had passed and she didn't realize it. That's why it says, you know, you're repeating pre-recorded things they used to say in universities and books on left-wing politics. Well, now it's even more so than it ever was, from what I can tell. I mean, you know, the whatever you want to call that mode of thinking and talking, postmodern, they have a lot of names for
neo-Marxism
right now. Neo-Marxism,
critical theory,
intersectional, whatever the buzzwords are. It's come back with a vengeance, and now it controls everything, it seems like, pretty much. I was a little more secure in the ridicule than I probably would be now. But that's one of the things about songs, art, what have you. It not only exists in its own world, divorced from time and anything outside it, but it also is a snapshot of a particular state of mind of the and time of the artist. And that's definitely, it's like a historical, not a historical novel. We don't have a word for historical song. But whatever, the song equivalent of a historical novel would be a song like that. People, I tell you though, people with your background universally love it. And those are the people who love it. Nobody else ever mentions it. But it's anyone who's been to grad school. If someone tells me that's their favorite song, I know, okay, you went to grad school.
Well, on that, because with freedom of expression and what's changed, and you do go to high schools and you're a young adult author, and there's a lot of controversies there too about young adult authors and what they can say. Do you have any theory about what has happened? Because, I mean, your whole life has kind of been about expression and saying things, and you've been in different scenes where it was about expression, and obviously punk rock being the biggest example of that. Do you have any theory about what happened?
What happened?
Yeah, why we have college students, protesting on this, and why free speech seems to be heavily under attack from the left, the kind of people who probably have punk rock bands. I mean, I imagine I've been to a punk rock show in a while, especially not with teenagers, but if that kind of anti-free speech rhetoric is being punkified, if you go to a show now, they might be singing about, you know, why liberalism is hate speech or some of these things that you hear coming out of campuses.
Maybe. The premise of your question is right, but it's a post-rock world that we live in now. I think that brand of that collegiate rhetoric, what's that Olympia College the Brett Weinstein incident.
Yeah, there's so many. You know, I can't even keep track. Yeah.
Those kids are not listening to rock, to punk rock and rock music. There's a line that separates us from them as far as culture and music. I mean, it's when my band does shows, it's all people well into adulthood. They sometimes bring their kids. And there's maybe a few oddball teenagers that become interested in it as well. But it's not the same sort of thing. It's not on the cutting edge of anything, which is what it is. I've found that kind of liberating in a way that since there's no possibility of ever being jumping into the mainstream at all by any means, it's kind of a bit freeing for what you can do, at least your attitude. But as far as the question goes, yes, I do kind of have a theory of this. This is something that I came across in Thomas Merton's diaries, and it's a quote that I've quoted many times because it really hit me like, it was like a lightning bolt, where he's talking about the politics within the Catholic Church. But what he says is, I pulled it up here just as you were asking the question, both the conservatives and the progressives seem to me to be full of the same kind of intolerance, arrogance, and empty-headedness, and to be dominated by different kinds of conformism, in either case, the dread of being left out of their reference group. And I read that when I first saw it. I read it 10 times, and it suddenly dawned on me that of all the confusion that is wrought by trying to understand politics and political rhetoric and actions and thought and everything, it is ultimately human behavior, and usually a situation like that can be far more easily understood with reference to group dynamics and behavioral psychology. And I have since sort of following that teaching as far as how to look at political behavior, I have never seen a situation that does not a political situation that does not bear that out. And certainly in this social media world on Twitter might have been created as a grand illustration of it on purpose. I think that, and it's some of the same social dynamics though that I observed and hated and sort of cast the jaundiced eye on and ridiculed back when I was a kid, which is, we are basically glorified chimpanzees, and part of their behavior is that the strong identify the weak and then they descend on them and rip them apart viciously and bloodily. And we can kind of justify it with high-flown rhetoric and do it because of being humans, we adopt a righteous mantle for ourselves when we do it. And everybody does it and everybody participates in it. I cannot think of a better explanation for the phenomenon that you refer to than that.
So when we talk about this phenomenon, we tend to see it – the examples that are given of it are either on Twitter, like Twitter mobs, or on campuses. But you – so as a YA author, you write books about high school kids. A lot of your audience is high school kids, and so I know you go around and give – readings and perform for high school groups. Do you think that this same sort of stuff is as prevalent with that younger generation as well?
Well, I've heard stories about schools that deliberately try to inculcate this, which I've never encountered. I think a school like that would never bring me to their school. That's for sure. What I'll say, I'm not a very good person to ask about that because I only see it from one side, and you know, you can't tell what you in any serious way what's going on. You go to a classroom or a school auditorium of, you know, captive audience of kids bored out of their skulls who are, you know, there's nothing. You're lucky if you can get any. I mean, I'm fortunate because I've got a secret weapon, which is the song "Even Hitler Had a Girlfriend," which, no matter what audience I play it for, it always captures their attention and it always gets a laugh. But in general, beyond that, I couldn't say. But what I will say is that to the degree that my books have struck a chord with actual teenagers, it is what that shows to me, and I know this not just from – it's not just fanciful speculation. It's because I have I talk to them and I get emails from them and messages and so forth, that the essential experience of alienation that expressed in those books, and I tried very hard to make it both – universally applicable, but also in, you know, different enough from all the other versions of it as to justify its own existence, that still strikes a chord, and that things have not changed since the experiences I had that made me think of that stuff and the experiences people had now. I mean, I suppose that's like that bears out a conservative insight, you know, of there being nothing new under the sun. But as far as what, you know, what kind of politics these kids will have when they are forced into a situation where they have to adopt a politics, which I think is a kind of a tragedy in a way, that this is a necessary part of life that we have now. You know, who knows? I think they will adopt the safest, generally the safest one, the one that prevents you from being torn apart by the dominant people. That's what most people do.
Well, then let me maybe as a final question then, you got your start into this as part of the alienated, rebellious youth and built your career in a scene that attracted alienated, rebellious youth and now write novels largely about alienated, rebellious youth. And so looking back, if you're talking to the next 13-year-old kid getting rocks thrown at him because he's listening to bizarre music, what advice do you have for the alienated youth of today, to the person who looks up to you and wants to know how to go about it?
Yeah, it's terrible advice. Real, I mean, it's a horrifying, the advice is a horrifying message, which is that it doesn't get better, it gets worse, and try to keep your head down, but you'll probably not be successful at that. The only saving grace is that you could, you know, retreat into your own world and build something interesting there that you might be able to make use of in the future if you become an artist. And that's which is not necessarily that encouraging, but I think there is some solace in communing with you know, the like-minded people and people who've said and experienced interesting things in the past. So, you know, doing as much reading as you can never goes astray. I've been asked the advice question, and I don't have good advice. I don't think there's any good way to navigate this, and there's no redemption. You just have to fend for yourself as best you can, which is often not good enough, frankly, to protect yourself. But if you join an ideological mob, you will regret it because you will look back on it and you know, they that never goes well if only because what you're doing when you do that is you're farming out your own mind to other people whose motives may well be nefarious and whose actions almost always are. So, yeah, I would advise radical individualism.
Not complaining, I'm just figuring out how everything left is behind. I got my problems, I'm aware of them. I'll take care of them, never you mind. You're still repeating pre-recorded things they used to say in universities and books on left-wing politics and law about underlying structures that, so far as they mean anything, still won't support the personal connections that you draw. Institutionalized misogyny, that's all that stands between my baby and me.
Thanks for listening. This episode of Free Thoughts was produced by Tess Terrible and Evan Banks. To learn more, visit us at www.libertarianism.org.